I was asked, I mean, as you know, matrix models never go away, and they've come back in full force in the last year or two with Robert and Kuhlman's work, and more recently with the understanding that some of the old models we were playing with about 14 years ago have a very nice extension to supersymmetric two-dimensional gravity and make a lot of the stuff we were doing legitimate and much more interesting. And this is an enormous subject. There are many experts in the room who could do probably a better job than I. And I doubt if I'll get as far as I hope to, but I'll try. And I'll start at the beginning, and it'll be quite elementary. There are many different ways of looking at this whole subject. I'll refer to a few of them. Let me, for those of you who are, and this is really aimed at people who know nothing about the subject, that's not the experts in the audience. And I think there are such people here who, it was only colored chalk. So let me give some good reviews for those of you who want much more information, which you'll need. So there's a, there's a book, Proceedings of the Jerusalem Winter School, which I ran in 1989. So that's called Two-Dimensional Quantum Gravity. So that's the Jerusalem School. It's from 91, I guess. There's a review article by Igor Klebanov on the C equals 1 theory, which is of most interest, 91. It's on the it's in the archive. There's a nice review by Ginsburg and Moore from 93. And then there's a very nice paper by Joe, also a review, and was one of the papers that killed the subject. Joe proved the theorem, and as you, we physicists know, it's very dangerous when people prove theorems, that, that the approaches we'd been pursuing up to then for the two-dimensional non-critical string theory were sort of doomed. It was impossible to have a reasonable explanation. This, of course, has been shown to be wrong by the recent work. As usual, there was a hidden assumption which wasn't correct or didn't have to be correct. But anyway, so that's a, and you'll find many more references to the original papers in these reviews. So, matrix model have been around since 1974, so it's almost 30 years. And they began with the work of Ed Hooft on the large number of colors, rank of gauge group expansion for QCD. Now, it of course was well known for many years preceding that it was very useful to consider quantum mechanical systems of which were symmetric under some symmetry group for a large rank of that symmetry group. So for vector models, which the basic fields were in the fundamental representation, say, of SUN for large n, theory simplifies so much that one can always solve such models, and that was proved to be extremely useful in condensed matter physics, so-called spherical model. And Ed Hooft looked at the same problem for a theory in which the dynamical variables were, of course, matrices, n by n Hermitian matrices, or gauge fields, and discovered that there was also a simplifying feature of the quantum mechanics of such objects when one appropriately scaled the rank of the group to infinity and the coupling accordingly, except that it was much more complicated and interesting and rich than the case where you had vector fields. And so what he did was analyze the structure of Feynman graphs in the large n limit, and by cleverly representing the propagator of such fields, which carry two indices, by double index lines, and the vertices by appropriate index flow that is consistent with a group theory, he could give a graphical representation for an arbitrary Feynman graph, which consisted of propagators and vertices, in terms of index loops, where all the group theory was taken into account by the various loops, which gave factors of n. Vertices, of course, gave powers of couplings. And he could very easily analyze the independence of an arbitrary Feynman graph. And as you all know, I think, I won't go through it, what he discovered was that it was a very simple topological characterization of the Feynman graphs that emerged. And in particular, as n, the number of colors or the rank of the gauge group, went to infinity, the dominant and you scaled the coupling to vanish like 1 over n, that the only surviving graphs were planar graphs that could be drawn, say, for vacuum graphs on the surface of a sphere without crossing any of these index lines. And more generally, if one were to consider, say, the partition function, so for the kind of generic matrix model I'll write down will not be, let me just, the kind of matrix models we'll be interested will not be gauge theories, but theories of scalar fields. So this is an n by n Hermitian matrix, so a generic, any number of dimensions, a generic action would be something like the integral over space-time, the trace of, say, a kinetic term for the field and some potential. So a generic scalar field theory, which is SUN invariant, phi is Hermitian, and invariant under unitary transformations. Typically, what appears here is 1 over g squared, which we'll write as n over lambda. And log of z, which is or the so-called free energy, which is the sum of, in perturbation theory, of connected vacuum graphs. Using this double index analysis, can be shown to be given by an expansion in powers of 1 over n squared where the power of 1 over n squared is determined by the genus, or the number of handles, of the Riemann surface one gets by tiling these index graphs. So in particular, a planar graph, which can be represented by a sphere without lines crossing, has no handles, and so on. And the power of n in general is 1 over n squared to the number of handles minus 1. So the leading term comes from graphs that can be drawn on the sphere without crossing. And obviously, the free energy goes like n squared, roughly, because z is e to the minus n times the trace, which has another n. And whenever you have non-planarity, or whenever index lines cross and you have to draw the thing on a Riemann surface of higher genus in order to, you lose a power of 1 over n squared for each handle. For a given genus, for a given order in the non-planarity, you then have to sum over all graphs with various coefficients, which are determined by doing the Feynman integrals times the coupling, which is kept fixed, so-called Hund coupling. You get a power series, as usual in Feynman perturbation series. The remarkable thing about the genus expansion of this type is that the coefficients in the power series expansion for a given genus, for a set of Feynman diagrams that correspond to a Riemann surface of given genus, only grows like a power of n, the order of perturbation theory, as opposed to the n factorial that you get in if you were to sum over all genus. So normally, diagrams like this, perturbative expansions of any interesting quantum mechanical system in quantum field theory are badly divergent and have zero radius of convergence. However, if you restrict yourself to term by term to powers of 1 over n squared, you get geometric series which have some finite radius of convergence. Now, the original application of this was to QCD. Ed Hoff managed to solve two-dimensional QCD, which is an interesting model of confinement in two dimensions. It's rather simple, but could solve it analytically for n goes to infinity, the leading limit. And the other idea that came out of Ed Hoff's original paper was that this looks very much like some extent like the surfaces that correspond to these Feynman graphs look very much like string amplitudes. And perhaps it's an indication that QCD should be described by a string theory where the 1 over n squared, in some sense, is the string coupling. And there should be some kind of effective string theory that reproduces these terms by summing over string world sheets of a given genus. That goal remains unfulfilled, but it's a subject of intense study nowadays. I mean, we sort of have a lot of evidence of that from ADS-CFT duality, and the search is on, indeed, for the string theory, for understanding the string theories that we believe, because of that duality, might describe confining theories like QCD. But that's another story. This work of Van't Hoff led to, in the 70s, to a study of the large n limit of matrix theories, theories whose dynamical variables were matrices and had an SUN or an SON or an SP2N symmetry group for large n in this kind of limit, which was sort of independent of quantum chromodynamics. And in particular, the seminal work of Brizard, Itzigsen, Parisi, and Zuber, which studied many general properties of such integrals, such matrix models, in simple cases, and tried to see how one could solve them. The historical chain then led to an attempt to use these large n matrix models, not as models of quantum chromodynamics, but as models of string theory. And here the idea was that as we'll see, that because of this, this topological structure of Feynman graphs in the large n limit, one could use simple field theories, very simple field theories that we'll be utilizing, in order to get a handle on two-dimensional Riemann surfaces, two-dimensional surfaces of arbitrary genus. And here the pioneering work was done by Kazakov and Migdal and David, François David, see, I'm not very powerful. And they were interested in trying to find, their idea was to use these matrix models to discuss non-critical, what is sometimes called non-critical string theory, or generally Liouville theory, in which one has a has to describe a string with some number of string coordinates, not in the critical dimensions, say, of 26 for the bosonic string, but fewer dimensions, perhaps. In fact, we'll be discussing strings in no dimensions. And where the Liouville degree of freedom in the two-dimensional metric supplies the required central charge that is necessary to make the theory conformally invariant. That's why these are called non-critical string theories, but of course they're the same footing as any other string theory. It's just that the Liouville degree of freedom doesn't decouple. So this, in continuum language, we describe such a string theory by a two-dimensional action. In which we have some number of matter fields. So mu will run from 1 to c. C is the number of dimensions of the space, you would think, is the number of dimensions of the target space. It's also the central charge of these free scalar fields. In addition, we have and this is the covariant derivative with respect to this two-dimensional metric, we have a possibility of a cosmological term. So this term gives us just the area of the two-dimensional surface. and perhaps n a critically a linear dilaton, which couples to the Einstein action, which of course in two dimension just gives a the Euler character, or twice 1 minus the number of handles. Now, this theory can be treated by continuum techniques, and there's a lot of work on the on the Liouville approach, and most importantly, it can often be compared with the discretized version of quantum gravity that I'll be discussing in special cases. Now, the idea of Migdal and Kazakov and David was to try to write down a discretized, discrete version of the path integral, or the, you want the integral over metrics and matter fields with this action that defines the quantum string theory. The hard part, of course, is this measure. And what they wanted to do was to find a discretized way of summing over random two-dimensional surfaces and also over matter fields. And I think part of the original motivation was to put the thing on a computer. So this is hard to do. So is QCD. Often we put QCD on a computer, we get numbers, calculate the spectrum of hadrons, could do the same for string theory. So first thing is how to discretize two-dimensional space. Well, obviously you want to take your space and break it up into points and connect the points with polygons. In other words, you want a triangulation of the space. So in two dimensions, it's very easy to imagine discretizing space by representing the two-dimensional manifold as a bunch of triangles. Each triangle will be totally flat. That defines a metric, in a sense, where all the curvature is located at the vertices. And we can choose the triangles to be of equal area, equilateral, and say of area square root of 3a squared over 4, if a is basic side of a triangle. And the idea is to consider, instead of all summing over all surfaces in some sense, over all metrics with a given topology, summing over all triangulations of a surface of a given topology, and given described by summing over all triangulations, and obviously given a triangulation, we can both determine the area here as well as the Euler character just by the data that defines a triangulation, and perform the sum if we know how many triangulations there are given area and given Euler character. Then we also have to put matter onto this surface. So the simplest way of doing a triangulation is to use triangles. Of course, one, there's nothing special about trying to represent a continuous surface by triangles. One can use arbitrary polygons. And but it shouldn't matter in the continuum limit. So in the end, after writing this sum as a sum over discrete triangles, one will imagine taking a continuum limit where the number of triangles goes to infinity and the size of a area of a given triangle vanishes, and then it shouldn't matter what kind of triangulation one chooses. One of the nice immediate features of the analysis is that that in fact is the case, that you have this universality, and you might as well stick to triangles because they're the simplest, but you can use any polygons to tile your surface generically. Well, triangles are nice, and they give a simple way of associating matter with such a triangulation by putting the matter on the faces of these triangles or on the dual lattice. So the dual lattice is the lattice of points, one for each face, joined by links across the adjoining sides. And the dual lattice to a triangulation using triangles is a graph that has only cubic vertices. So it's natural to put the matter on the faces so that, for example, if you just use triangles, you get just cubic vertices. If you put it on the vertices, of course, you could have an arbitrary number of triangles coming into a given vertex. So we'll put the matter on the dual lattice, and then the clear choice for the matter action should be something like a discrete version of this kinetic energy. It should be a sum over nearest neighbors on the dual lattice. So these are points on the dual lattice. And this is just a discrete representation of the kinetic energy summed over components of the field and summed over nearest neighbors on the dual lattice. And if we use triangulation, there are exactly three nearest neighbors for a given lattice point, say this one. And we sum over those three to get a discrete representation of the Laplacian. So that would be the matter action. And then we could write down a discrete version of the sum over all surfaces and all matter fields by summing over all triangulations of genus H, or with H handles. And the coefficient there we'll call the string constant, except we'll call it G naught for the moment. That should be weighted by 2H minus 1. So G naught is roughly, you know, e to the minus e to the dilaton. So this is the weight we associate with a given genus. Then we sum for a given genus over all triangulations with area V. V would be the number of vertices. Or the number of triangulations. Well, we're going to sum over all triangulations. So this is all triangulations with genus G, genus H. And a given triangulation will have, in general, V vertices of the dual lattice. That's the same as the number of triangles. And so the exponential of lambda times the area we'll write as kappa to the V, where kappa essentially is e to the minus the area of a given triangle times the cosmological, or the cosmological constant. So this represents the area term in the action. This represents the topological term. This is the string coupling. This essentially is the exponential of the cosmological constant. And so for a given triangulation of genus H with V vertices, we have to now, we fix the triangulation, we have to do the integral over the matter fields. And there's one for each vertex of the dual lattice. And the action is just a product over nearest neighbors of this Green's function, xi minus xj, where g of x we see is just e to the minus x squared, Gaussian Green's function, divided by 2. So that's the exponential of this Laplacian, Skretar's Laplacian. So this is the proposal for the discrete version of summing over all surfaces with matter on it. And the idea is to, if you want, put this on a computer and then try to approach the continuum limit by adjusting the coefficients so that this sum is weighted by terms with an infinite number of vertices, infinite number of triangles, as sort of A goes to 0. In general, this will be some constant here. We'll try to adjust kappa to approach the critical point where this sum will be dominated by an infinite number of triangles of infinitesimal area, so the total area remains finite. And that'll give us the string partition function. It's not unreasonable that we can do that, because, as I said here, these series for a given number of handles, or a given term in the H expansion, these series will tend to diverge, be geometric series, which will have algebraic singularities as we crank up the coupling, crank up kappa. Now, I'll come back to this later for the one-dimensional case, where mu, remember here I said goes from 1 to c, the number of components, the dimensionality of the target space. For c greater than 1, there are many reasons why this approach is difficult, although it has been utilized on the computer. People have done extensive numerical simulations of matter coupled to two-dimensional gravity with inconclusive results, put it mildly. For c greater than 1, the problems are those which are typically found in bosonic string theory. Namely, there is a tachyon in the spectrum of the string. So the bosonic string by itself is unstable. And nobody until recently, had any good ideas as to what that means. This is closed string theory. And we're still not sure what that means for C greater than 1. For C equals 1, the tachyon is massless. So things are marginally better, but instabilities still occur. And the big advance recently is that one can understand sort of that these bosonic string theories one constructs actually decay to supersymmetric string theories, which are free of instabilities. From a more technical point of view, the C equals 1 or C less equal to 1, although what it means to have C fractional isn't obvious here, are controllable and soluble by the matrix model techniques I'll discuss. Because we'll be able to reduce these matrix models that we'll use to enumerate the surfaces to a very small class of variables. Another way of saying that physically is that for C less or equal to 1, when the target space is less than one dimension, which will correspond to string theories in less or equal to two dimension. Remember, the Liouville degree of freedom essentially gives another dimension to space-time, have no stringy excitations. There are no transverse modes of oscillation. So string theories in less or equal to two dimensions are essentially have very few degrees of freedom. Whereas once you get above two dimensions, you have all the infinite modes of the string. And so that's a much harder problem. And so really, all of this approach so far has been limited to less than two dimensions. OK, now, the simplest case is zero dimensions, or one dimension, where we have what would we could think of as pure gravity, where we have no matter at all, so we just drop the matter and we just have pure gravity. And that is the first case that we'll discuss, C equals 0, in which case we're just summing over random surfaces. So we just have a sum in the discretized version over triangulations of a two-dimensional surface of genus H, weighted by a string constant to the power H. Is e to the cosmological constant to the number of vertices, number of triangles. And the matter integral is not there. We just have 1 for each such triangulation. So here we have simply the number of triangulations of a two-dimensional surface of genus H and a given area, or a given number of triangles. And so the only problem here is a counting problem. How do you count how many triangulations of given genus, given number of triangles you have? And this is where the idea came to use matrix models to do that. Because after all, matrix models, remember the Feynman graph expansion of the free energy of matrix models gave a sum over graphs of given genus and some given order and perturbation theory. And our dual graphs here the dual lattice to the triangulation is just a Feynman graph of a phi cube theory. So the dual lattice to the triangulation is just a vacuum phi cubed graph. So this number is the same number as the number of phi cubed graphs that you can draw using double index notation on a Riemann surface of genus, on a two-dimensional surface of genus H with V vertices. And that you can get from a simple matrix model. So this should be log, to get the free energy, of an integral over a matrix model in zero dimensions, so that the Feynman graphs are all trivial, give you one, and are just weighted in the same way. So I claim that this is the same as the integral over an n by n scalar Hermitian matrix. With a mass term and some cubic coupling. And why is that? Well, this is just, as I told you, at Hooft established, that the Feynman graph expansion of this will give, if I take the logarithm to get the connected graphs, a sum over H. Sum over the number of handles, which the Feynman graph can be drawn on the surface of H handles, where I interpret 1 over n squared as g naught, string coupling. And this factor of kappa, the coupling constant here, clearly the number of times it appears will be the number of vertices in the Feynman graph, is the same as the number of triangles in the dual lattice. So that's the same kappa as this. And the Feynman graphs themselves are trivial because there's no space-time. Each propagator gave me a number, factors of n, which went into forming this power. And that's it. So the idea was to use this field theory, which is a zero-dimensional field theory, just an integral, matrix integral, to calculate this number and then evaluate this sum. And that's looks pretty straightforward. And this was good because, at least for large n, n goes to infinity, Brezin, Etzigson, Zuber, and Parisi showed how to calculate such integrals exactly by saddle point. Now, you might think that if you want to keep G naught fixed and have a string theory with finite string coupling, not turn off the interaction, you'd have to keep n finite. And then instead of having a simple limit, I mean a limit of something which you might be able to calculate by saddle point techniques, you'd just have a complicated 17 by 17 dimensional integral. And that would be pretty bad. But what's going to happen is that g naught here, which is 1 over n squared, is going to get renormalized by this sum multiplicatively. And in the end, we'll find out, and that was the big discovery in 1999, the so-called double scaling limit, that this thing will end up being 1 over n squared times, essentially, kappa minus kappa c, point at which this series begins to diverge as you approach a critical point to some power. And what will really govern the expansion will not be 1 over n squared, but 1 over n squared times this quantity. Minus, let's say, put it downstairs. And that allows you to define a double scaling limit where this becomes G string. So that as kappa goes to kappa C, n goes to infinity, keeping the string coupling fixed, one gets, in fact, the continuum string. The point at which kappa, this power series, diverges, the singular, is, of course, the point where the sum over triangulations with V triangles is weight begins to be dominated by an infinite number of triangles. So the mean number of vertices will go like kappa minus kappa C. So in fact, in the continuum limit, as this thing diverges, the coupling is renormalized in such a way that you want to go to the critical point, take kappa to kappa C, and let n go to infinity. So in fact, we are really interested in the behavior of these integrals when n goes to infinity, always, but also when kappa goes to some kind of critical point. But first, let's just do the large n limit. So n goes to infinity. So from the point of view of string theory, then, we're in a sense just summing over triangulations of the sphere. And we have to evaluate this integral. Now, this isn't totally trivial because you can't just look for extrema of the action, even though you have an n here. The trace itself goes is of order n because you have n squared degrees of freedom here. So this measure also goes like e to the n squared. And of course, you balance the two. So this problem was first solved, as I said, by Brzezinski and Zuber and Parisi, who transformed to wrote the integral in terms of the eigenvalues. Clearly, because of the SUN symmetry, the action here only depends on the eigenvalue, so it's natural to diagonalize the matrix by a unitary transformation. And call the eigenvalues x. So x is a diagonal matrix of eigenvalues. And then we want to change the measure to an integral over the eigenvalues. And an integral over the unitary matrices we use to diagonalize the matrix. So this is our measure, times some Jacobian, which should depend only on the eigenvalues. And the action, of course, will just depend on the eigenvalues. The Jacobian, which depends on the eigenvalues, is easily written down because it must be totally symmetric in the x's, since you can switch the x's around by a permutation, which is a unitary transformation. transformation. So it's symmetric in the x's. And it can only have singularities where the diagonalization is ambiguous, which is where two eigenvalues coincide. So it's only singular when xi equals xj. And therefore, it must be some power of the van der Monde determinant, which is defined to be the product of xi minus xj. And then you simply use the scaling of the phis, dimensional arguments, to show that this power must be 2. So as you multiply phi by some constant, this gets multiplied by, for Hermitian matrices, by constant to the n squared minus n, and this has half such powers of x, so you need power of this. So you just get van der Monde squared. So in the end, we'll have log of integral. We can do the u integration since nothing depends on it. We're left with a product of n integrals over the eigenvalues. And then we have what I'll call in general a potential, a v of xi. So this is my potential v of phi. We don't have to restrict ourselves to just this potential, mass term minus cubic term. We could do it for any potential, any polynomial in phi. And then we have this term from the Jacobian, which we exponentiate and write as a sum I not equal to j, less than j, log of xi minus xj squared. So now, having reduced this integral to an integral over the n eigenvalues, one is in a position to take the large n limit just as a simple saddle point. There are only n variables here. V is the trace of something, so it goes like n. So this goes like n squared, and this is a sum over I and j going from 1 to n. This also goes like n squared. And so this is the dominant term in the integral, and its minima will determine the value of the integral as n goes to infinity. There's also a very pretty physical interpretation of this system. We have a potential, which will, say, in the phi cubed case, look something like this. Has a minimum somewhere. So this is v. This is the eigenvalues. If we just had this term, of course, the eigenvalues would all pile up at the minimum. However, we have this term, which could be regarded as the logarithmic repulsion between these eigenvalues. They don't want to get close together. Increases the energy. The eigenvalues repel, and we have a one-dimensional Coulomb gas, if you want. This is our dimension, and this is the logarithmic repulsive potential between two eigenvalues. So they all can't pile up at the minimum. They'll spread themselves out about the minimum, balancing the potential energy against this repulsion. So that's the limit. And then all we have to do is find the minima, the distribution of eigenvalues for large n. So the minimization is quite simple. You get 1/2 v prime of xi we differentiate with respect to xi, I've taken the n over to the other side, sum over I less than j, 1 of over xi minus xj. And the factor of 2 came from here. So we have to solve this equation for each I. And but we're only interested in the limit as n goes to infinity. So as n goes to infinity, we expect that these eigenvalues are going to form a continuous distribution of eigenvalues. And so we introduce a density of eigenvalues, which is a sum of delta functions, which should approach some smooth distribution we expect as n goes to infinity. So in terms of this, clearly what we have, the equation is 1/2 v prime of x for continuous x now, ranging over the support of the eigenvalue distribution, equals, well, this is just an integral dy of the density of eigenvalues, 1 over x minus y. So that picks out the sum for finite n. And we have to take the principal value to avoid I equals j, of course. So we have a standard Riemann-Hilbert problem to solve. And what we want to do is determine, given the potential V, which is written as a dispersion relation, in terms of density of eigenvalues, we want to solve for rho given V. And then, of course, we can plug that back in to calculate the integral. So the way this is solved is standard. As you know, we define a function, an analytic function of for which this is the real part. So for z in the complex plane, which has the property of approaching 1 over z at infinity. Rho is normalized to unity, its integral. And this integral here will run over the support of rho. So rho, of course, will have some region of compact support where the eigenvalues are located. So f is an analytic function outside the support of rho. Its imaginary part, its discontinuity, as we approach the real axis, is equal to minus to rho along the region where rho has support. And its real part out is, of course, given by the principal value of that integral, which is just 1/2 of v prime of x. So we now have turned it into the Riemann-Hilbert problem, where we have to solve, given the real part of the function, we have to construct its imaginary part, given asymptotic conditions. Now, we can do this for an arbitrary function, v, which generalizes what we're interested in to start with, which was just a cubic polynomial. And, well, let me So let's, in fact, write it down for an arbitrary function, v. So V is some polynomial. And in general, for an arbitrary function V, arbitrary polynomial, the potential will look like this, quite complicated. And one could imagine situations where the eigenvalues, some of them lie here, some of them lie here, some of them lie here, some of them lie here. And those are all interesting cases. These are cases where the where a row has support here and then here and so on. In other words, this function will have discontinuities, will have cuts here, separate cuts. And this is called, in general, the multi-cut situation or multi-cut solutions. And I'm not going to discuss them, although Robert probably will. They're very useful for his game. And they're very useful, in general, for the structure of the speed approach to quantum gravity as well. But let me just write down the simplest case where we just have a single cut, one cut like here. Okay. So for one cut, well, first let me write down the general thing. Get it right. That's easy enough, but to analyze it. So to construct the function here, we know that function should go like v prime to give us the correct real part. And then we also know this function is real on the real axis. It's real analytic. So what we expect is that it should be given by something with a square root branch point. Of this form, where the imaginary part will arise from those regions where this polynomial, so these are both polynomials, is negative. And the imaginary part will just be then proportional to this, so that rho of x will be minus 1 over pi q of x square root of minus p when p is negative. And in order to determine q and p, given v, all we have to do is satisfy two conditions. One is we have to make sure that rho remain positive and that f go like 1 over z at infinity. So in general, we can achieve that for any potential v of z, which say is a polynomial of degree 2m. By choosing q to be a polynomial of degree 2m minus 2, let's see. To be of 2m minus 2, and p to be polynomial of some degree. Oh, and p to be just, if I want to choose the one cut situation, will be simply a squared minus p less than 0, z squared minus a squared. So I'm choosing the endpoints of the cut to be symmetric at plus or minus a. In fact, here I've just chosen the case of even polynomials, even potentials. Simplify. And it's easy to see that if V is a polynomial of degree 2n, even polynomial in the case I'm considering, then this is a polynomial of degree 2m minus 1. And if Q, I choose Q to be a polynomial of degree 2m minus 2, then I can determine all the coefficients in Q by expanding this at infinity and demanding that it go like 1 over z. And there is a unique solution to that, which is trivial to work out. An example is if I choose V to be symmetric, so now I'm using squares actually and not triangles, 1 over 1 half x squared plus g over 2 x fourth. So that's a potential which looks like this, or like this if g is negative. So that case, that corresponds to m equals 2. You choose q to be quadratic, p to be a simple square root branch point at plus or minus a, and you demand that you have the correct expansion at infinity, and you find that there's a unique solution, f of z, which is 1 half z plus gz cubed. That's v prime over 2. And then you adjust q. So then we'll adjust q so that this thing behaves in the correct way. You find that q has to be equal to, we determine the quadratic term by canceling this, and then you cancel the z term. And you get you still have to determine A, which comes from determining the coefficient of 1 over Z. And that gives you an equation for the position of the branch point. Then you solve that for A, for the position of the branch point, and you find quadratic equation. And that's the answer. You can plug that back in and finally determine rho, which is just essentially q times this thing for z less than a. And it's essentially the famous Wigner semicircular law for the eigenvalue density modified by something. Which in general is some random number near the point, near the tip of this branch point. So what have we done? We've done the matrix integral, this matrix integral for large n for a quartic potential. And we found the density of eigenvalues, from which we can, of course, calculate the action. Yeah?
Shouldn't Q be linear in A so that the equation reduces and the limit
A
goes to 0?
Because A doesn't really go to 0 except G goes to infinity.
So A is not the same A before it's going to the bottom?
No. A here was. Okay, forget about. Yeah, I shouldn't have used the same A. A is just the position of the cup. So my potential looks like that. And the eigenvalues are going to pile up. It's symmetric, so the eigenvalues are going to go from a to minus a. If you turn off the coupling, you have a Gaussian. Of course, a Gaussian you can do exactly. An original Gaussian integral, kappa equals 0. And that's the Wigner Gaussian distribution that was analyzed. Probably the first analysis of random matrix models, but only for free non-interacting theories where it's sort of trivial from this point of view. And then, of course, A becomes equal to 2, and you get, and G is 0, so this is just 1 over 2 pi, 4 minus x squared, which is Wigner's semicircular law for the distribution of eigenvalues, the square root distribution here vanishing at the endpoint like a square root. You also notice that A here, which enters into the density and into the action when you evaluate it, into the free energy, has a perturbative expansion in G. G is our kappa, the coupling. So you can expand this series in a power series in G, and the radius of convergence is 1/12. There's a singularity at minus 1/12. That's when the series begins to diverge. That will be the critical point that one needs to get this so-called double scaling limit later. You can see what happens at 1/12. You see, in general, this density of eigenvalues has a square root, vanishes like the eigenvalues vanish here like square root. But when you approach a critical point, when GC goes to minus the 12th, right, so A squared goes to 8, and GC equals minus the 12th, and X equals 8, X equals square root of 8, you'll see that this thing vanishes. That's the point. So as GC, this will behave like, I guess, 8 minus x squared to the 3, perhaps. So at this critical point, the nature of the singularity there will change. What is happening? This is the wrong picture. Where is that divergence coming from? Well, as you crank down GC, the picture becomes like this, you know, for GC negative. So you had some distribution of eigenvalues, and you make GC negative, potential turns down. The integral we started with then is pretty bad, because e to the minus v will then blow up for large x. But in the large n limit, you don't see that. You just see the settle point. You continue to decrease GC, you get to the point where the eigenvalue density reaches the top. That's where, clearly, where some kind of singularity is going to happen. So imagine what happens after you get to the top, right? Well, then the eigenvalues start going down here. They've got no reason not to fall down to infinity. So that's when the series, the perturbative expansion, begins to diverge. So it's when the eigenvalues hit the top of this potential. And that's the critical point. That divergence is what's used for the double scaling limit someplace. And even before taking the double scaling limit, doing the analysis that allowed one to solve this theory to all orders of 1 over n, one already saw this multi-critical point and could argue that as you approached that critical point, or as you tuned this potential so the GC approached minus 1/12, one got the kind of divergence that led to the scaling behavior that one expected from analysis of minimal models of this low-dimensional non-critical string theory. That gave an enormous boost to this approach. Just the large n limit. Now, if you have a polynomial of degree 2m, you can even do better than that. You can tune the potential so that the density vanishes more. Rapidly. and try to recover other interesting, less generic versions of pure gravity, which correspond to having pure gravity with some kind of matter attached to them. And it turns out that with a polynomial here, just this one matrix model of the polynomial of the arbitrary degree, one can describe the so-called PQ minimal models for P equals 2 and Q equals 2m minus 1. These are the informally invariant two-dimensional theories. Unitary theories, but now coupled to random, now on a random geometry. And they have C, a central charge of P6 times P minus Q squared over PQ. In the case we're discussing here, this M is related to the maximal vanishing of rho that you can achieve with a polynomial of degree 2m. And the case we're considering here is P equals 2, Q equals 3, which you can easily see has C equals 0. That's pure gravity, no matter. And higher degrees of Q, higher values of Q, correspond to C less than 1 but greater than 0, to some minimal models, the first of which is the so-called Li-Yang edge singularity. Actually, that is negative C. Sorry? C is minus 22/5. Yeah. So not all of these are unitary, in fact. So in the beginning, it was actually somewhat confusing as to what the general set of multicritical points one can get here should be compared with what model in the lattice. But let's just stick at the moment to this case of C equals 0, pure gravity. I haven't even got to the double scaling. So how does one solve this to all errors? Well, actually, as I said, there's no way of solving this to all orders for a general V. But, as I also said, we're not interested in the exact solution. We're interested in the limit n goes to infinity, but adjusting the potential so as to approach a critical point where the perturbation series diverges and we get a finite string coupling. That's a double scaling limit. And remarkably, one can solve this model exactly in that limit. So I'll just say one or two words about that, and then I suppose I'll have to stop. I'm not going to get this equals 1. What?
How much more time?
Another hour. So, so the technique that was used to solve the general case is not saddle point. Obviously, saddle point is only going to buy you a systematic perturbative expansion. But was a technique introduced by Mehta originally. So instead of writing this, so the hard thing to integrate is, hard thing to deal with is that van der Maander, which is we exponentiated as a Coulomb potential. But instead, Mehta suggested that we write it. So, with some phase, which I'll add, as a determinant of xi to the power j minus 1, well, if I and j go from 1 to n. That obviously is the same thing. And so we have this determinant squared inside the integral, weighted with e to the minus v. Now, the determinant, if we expand it, is a product of these powers. Now, if that's not easy to integrate, what would be nice to integrate with this measure, dx e to the minus v, would be some functions that were orthonormal with respect to that. So what he suggested was, replace this by the determinant of a set of orthogonal polynomials, pi of x, pi of xj times some product of some numbers. So we're going to, what we can do is add rows and columns to form polynomials, and we'll choose, by Pn I mean of x, I mean xn, starts out like xn, and we'll normalize it in such a way that it will be orthogonal, orthonormal, to, with respect to this measure, dx e to the minus n v of x, Pn, Pm, equals delta nn. So by adding rows here, and normalizing, I can replace the entries here by orthogonal polynomials with respect to the measure that I have to integrate over. And that means that when I expand the square of this thing, I'll get products of orthogonal polynomials, and I can do those products. I can do those integrals. So all integrals are doable, and everything will reduce to these unknown h's, which I'll still have to determine. But that's just a property of this set of orthogonal polynomials. So if you do that, then of course, this free energy will be log of 2. So if you expand the determinant squared, you'll just get a bunch of products of these polynomials, and they're orthonormal. So in the end, you just get a product of these h's squared, hn. N goes from 1 to n minus 1, 0 to n minus 1. So n here goes from 0 to n minus 1 for each of the orthogonal polynomials times n factorial. So the integral is trivially expressed in terms of these h's. And so all you have to know is the property of orthogonal polynomials with this weight. These aren't normal, well-known functions, or arbitrary v, except for v equals a Gaussian, where they're Hermit polynomials, and you know everything about it. So what was done by these three groups back in 1989 was to, after, you know, the realization that what one wanted. So, I mean, there are various ways of trying to get a handle on these h's, right? When you have orthogonal polynomials, you derive recursion relations, and you can write them down, and you can't do anything with them. But what we realized back then was that we weren't interested in solving this integral in general. That's impossible. Just in the large n limit, appropriately scaling the coupling and the potential to get to this critical point. And then it turned out possible to solve. And a whole story emerges from there. But I should probably stop on that. You know.
You get your point.
I could do another one, but that would be better than going on. So, I mean, what happened is, if I'll talk and give another talk, then you then solve, essentially, these can be constructed in the appropriate large n limit, where n is the border, n goes to infinity, and the couplings, like kappa, are cleverly chosen. And this so-called double scaling limit then allowed one to write down the full answer to all orders in the string coupling, which is going to be 1 over n squared times kappa minus kappa c to some power. So we'll have a series of this with coefficients. So that's what I haven't gotten to. And the other thing, of course, I haven't gotten to was the even more interesting model where we put back a real continuous space-time where mu equals 1, and the so-called C equals 1 string theory in one spatial dimension and two space-time dimensions, which requires other techniques. And so I'll do both of those next time, sometime, to be arranged.
Definitely schedule a second talk, but any questions about this talk?
So, you try to approximate the all real surfaces by the discrete ready-plane relation. But I think it's true that it's not quite obvious that the semi-triangulable surfaces are dense. And anyway, when you refine the size, then look clear. Why the thing was uniformly dense enough. Is that another one?
Seems obvious. Seems obvious to a physicist, I must say, for two-dimensional surface.
The ones that are triangular.
Yes.
The ones that can define or the closure of the rationals. So you have some very complicated variety of one-way space. If the right were rational, you'd know that the rational forms are dense. It's definitely not rational variety. There are composed of projections saying that the rational forms are variety.
Well, but you see here, it's not such a, it's not only a question of whether we miss some surfaces or not, it's what their measure is. So we don't care about missing an infinite set of surfaces with zero measure.
I want to ask you in a slightly friendlier way.
Yeah.
What I've been wondering about during your talk is whether there were competing definitions. I mean, I think this is
yes.
a perfectly good definition
yeah.
for what a random surface is, and it has certain quality properties. And the Gaussian free field you describe GIJ or something like that, or you might.
Well, but then you lose the. We want to preserve all the symmetries.
Yes.
So the data we want to use here is just the data that makes, you know, that's minimal geometrical sense and nothing else. There is a alternative to this, which is the continuum Liouville theory. And, you know, I think without having that as a comparison, the reason I'm giving this lecture, because this technique, although, you know, discretized and ugly and it's not obvious, is incredibly powerful. It can do things that the much more elegant Liouville theory.
So what's that, the Liouville measure?
Well, it's just doing No, Leoville conformal field theory. So there you're integrating, you know, in a sense over continuum 2D metrics. You're doing the standard Polyakov string theory. Now that, so you're doing conformal field theory on a, so from the point of view of string theory, that's the natural definition. No discretization is involved. And the techniques there are quite powerful, and you can calculate a lot of things, and they always agree, and they gave enormous support to this proposal for discrete. That's the best support we have. And the Leoville theory, by the way, has developed over the years, so people can do more and more with the Leoville theory. Not still as much as matrix theory, which somehow is, you know, shows immediately an integrable structure that makes it extremely powerful. And they absolutely agree, so I think that's very good evidence. If you buy the Polyakov path integral as a definition of something over random surfaces, over geometries, of this discretized approach working. But, you know, I really find it hard to see how you run into problems, but I'm not sure. There may be subtleties that...
What about symmetry? The calculation of the symmetry, does it change its
way? Oh, yeah, I didn't mention that when you do Feynman graphs, of course, there is a symmetry factor which you divide out by, which is the number of automorphisms of the graph. So that's automatically taken into account. Otherwise, you'd get nonsense. There's no question about it. So that's automatically taken into account. All the geometrical, you know, the place where this becomes a real issue, obviously, is when you go beyond two dimensions. And people have tried Kazakov and Migdal and many people for decades now to do computer simulations of sums over random geometries in more than two dimensions by similar techniques. And that's been sort of disastrous and surely suffers from serious problems, because unlike two-dimensional surfaces, which you can classify easily, right, topologically, you can't do that in higher dimensions. So there you don't know what you're doing. And people haven't been very successful as well numerically.
Three dimensions.
Not to speak of analytically.
They had some results in three dimensions.
They had some results, but I'm not sure they really made sense. And there was nothing to compare with. But there I would see a problem. But I'm not exactly sure. Well, maybe the mathematicians should answer this. It seems, I mean, there's, as physicists, we can tell you with absolute sureness that this seems to work. This seems to define what would be the natural path integral or sum, gauge invariant sum over random surfaces, weighted by the area and the genus. And it has this gorgeous mathematical structure to it, so it's another good reason for it, I suppose. Does any of the experts in the audience, Greg, can you think of any other rejoinders?
You gave the one here to Ron. And this issue that Ron raised was actually discussed in the literature. There were other papers based on Galois' theorem, casting inversions on the
It's justified by? Results and agreement with and comparison level. But you can turn it into a, I'm not sure what you would, how you'd make it more rigorous, because as you said, is there another reasonable definition?
You know, Odette Schramm, many of you know, because of his work on the stochastic loop
neural. Right.
With a collaborator, he has a recent result that there is a random surface. That is, if you take the subsequential limit, fixing a base point of the triangulation with more and more triangles of the G-sphere, weighted discretely as you did, then you you've got a limit, and it's well defined, and it is a triangulation on the surface with probability one, which wasn't, isn't clear on priority because, for example,
so that's taking a particular triangulation.
Well, no, but it's a measure.
It defines it.
As a probabilistic object, you can produce the random, just like there's a Brownian motion, there's the notion of a random path. Mm-hmm. There is similar, on a similar mathematical footing, there is a random plane. And it has very interesting properties. They know its Hausdorff dimension is 4, not 2.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
But this is a surface in which kind of embedding space.
No.
Just intrinsic surface.
The random plane, which you get from the sphere by fixing the north pole as a base point, with probability 1, has the property that the number of triangles you see at radius r grows like r to the 4. That's just a fact about it. I mean, it's a little bit like a Brownian path. You know, it has length, like square root of the distance you draw.
The number of triangles you see at distance.
It's very wrinkled.
You expect
the random surface to be quite wrinkled. You don't expect You don't expect it to look like an equilateral triangulation of a plane where you walk out a r triangle and you see a disk as great as r squared. It's quite expected that it be somewhat wiggly, but it's actually known that it's the fourth power.
Do we know that? We do. Jack?
Some of those critical exponents,
it should be related to some critical exponents of it. But 4, I never heard it that way.
It's in number 4.
Yeah.
There's literature on
it. So what is this statement? You define it by...
Oh, how do you define it?
Yeah.
So you consider a base point. Mm-hmm. And then you consider the measure, discrete measure spaces of all triangulations of the two sphere. That point kind of collated. And then there's some subsequential limit that you can take of these measure spaces. And but the result is that it doesn't depend on the subsequence. You get a measure in the limit
to get the Hausdorff dimension, I ask how many triangles there are.
At radius r.
R links for me. All the triangles
you say how many, or you can are say
less
vertices.
Than,
it doesn't matter if you say vertices or triangles. You can say how many vertices can you visit by taking r steps from the margin base. But they're interesting points along the way. For instance, as you increase the number of triangles, the circular triangulation of the elements, you see that it's drawn 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, that's distance 1 from the arc, or even the origin could be blowing up. Mm-hmm. So you might think that in the limit you don't have even a triangulation, because there might be points that have infinite valence in the limit. But one of the things Schramm and his collaborators proved is that that's a measure zero of that.
Well, that's reasonable because that's...
you have to prove that the measure is actually concentrated on the geometric objects, which are...
Well, our definition of the measure suppresses things with our... I mean, it's weighted by the Einstein term. So it suppresses curvature.
You consider on an equal footing triangulations that have any valence at a vertex. You can take them all together.
Remember, the valence at a vertex has to average to zero. It's conceivable.
You could end up conceivably with a positive probability of running into a vertex of infinite valence and it not being a triangulation. So I'm just saying there are details in proving that the measure is supported on what you would hope it be supported, if you mark triangulation.
Right.
Okay.